Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking, what does union unity mean anymore? As always, I'm joined by my co-host and the man who I would actually rather not be joined to at this stage of the game, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you?
Not too bad. God, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. It's kind of a nice time. Much people get up at this hour.
Most people get up a few hours earlier, Martin. You're the only one who seems to be stuck in this bubble. We're doing a lot of these pods at the moment. We're knocking them out, but we do rely on patrons. It was nice to get a shout out the weekend by the Irish Times. On Wednesday evening, we're hoping to do a live show for patron only. So if you're on patreon.com/tortoiseshack, you'll be able to see a live show via Zoom with it. So if you want to see our faces, you know what, just click on the Patreon button and you'll get the link there. Much more important, we're delighted to be joined by Associate Professor for Economics for UL, Chief Economist Writer at The Currency, which is obviously a great read, Stephen Kinsler. Stephen, thank you for joining us on the pod.
It's my pleasure. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so thank you very much for having me.
Listen, we're going to jump straight in, and I'm going to go, I suppose I have to start immediately with the framework document that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael issued off the top of the bat. And when it came out, I initially went, you know, oh, this is populist. This is, it would be called populist if it was from anybody on the left. It would be called all of these things. And because, you know, we would have always said, you know, Fine Gael have this kind of center-right ideology. But I would say there's almost no ideology in that document. It's just a la carte, a bit of whatever you have in yourself. The economics in it, is that a fair assessment, or am I being overstating it?
Yeah, so I think the way I think about the document is it's a bunch of arguments that are designed to be lost. So you want to encourage people to say, I can put my stamp at document by increasing the amount of green, or I can increasing the amount of labor, or increasing the amount of social democrat, or increasing the amount of rural independent, or whatever, right? And that's fine. And it's got a couple of like hard red lines in it, which I think maybe bear discussion, but we'll see. Like, for example, the commitment not to increase income tax or USC over the next couple of years. Like, that is a really interesting one, because it instantiates a sort of a limit to spending. Right. If you say we're never increasing income taxes, it means that spending can't go up, which in a deficit position means spending has to go down on some certain categories. Right. That kind of stuff is there. So there is some ideology in there for sure. But the economics of it are, well, they're few and far between, because it doesn't deal with constraints, number one, and it doesn't deal with delivery, number two. And I've kind of been very strong over the last couple of weeks in particular in saying, look at, you know, we've been down this road before. We know what it looks like when the economy falls off the, you know, it's like a marble rolling off a table. You know, uniquely, really, you know, if there was ever going to be like a sort of a set of things we know we're good at, it's coming out of crisis, because we have them so frequently. And the document is just there basically to get other people to the table. And so to the extent that it contains things that, you know, other parties can come back and say, oh my God, we got X, or we beat them at Y, you know, a lot of it is that, I would imagine. I could have written that for you in an hour or two. Yeah. You know, so could you, you know.
It worries me, because I suppose you pick up on the main point is no tax increase, no USC. You can't have that and then say in the same breath and play within the EU fiscal rules. You know, it's just none of this. And then we're going to borrow all this money to do all this new housing thing that we're going to do, or whatever the take is. So yeah, I do think it was pretty vague. To broaden that out, though, and I suppose one of the main reasons we reached out to you is because I've been concerned about the EU, and we saw, you know, the all night meetings with the finance ministers, and then they want to come away with a fudge. Can you just explain the economics of where are we in terms of the EU? There's two houses here. There's one that wants a sharing of the debt burden, and there's one that effectively is saying you're on your own. Is that fair?
That's completely fair. That's I mean that's what's interesting about that discussion about that description is that it is exactly the same description that applied 10 years ago. Mm. So which is there are, you know, creditors and debtors. There are the frugal four and everyone else. And there are people who don't want to spend, and there are people who kind of want them to spend. And the metaphor has been really interesting. The metaphor that the Dutch in particular, the hardliners here, use is that, you know, somebody's house is on fire, you help them put it out, you don't take over their mortgage. That's a very compelling and easy metaphor to understand. Of course, a country is not a house, but the slight alteration of that metaphor that sort of gets you to where you need to be is it's not somebody's house that's on fire, it's somebody's apartment, and you share an apartment block with these people, right? That's the fundamental difference, is that if the apartment corridors are crappy, they're crappy for you and they're crappy for the people who don't have as much money. It is interesting to me that the nature of the European system is that it proceeds via fudge, you know. And like the previous discussion about the, you know, the outline document, it is, if you like, curtained by ideology on all sides, right? And you never really get behind those curtains. And I find that fascinating, because this crisis is very different from the previous two crises, right? You know, if you take the global economic crisis in 2007-2008, and then you take the sovereign debt crisis 3 years later, like, there's two very different crises. And then the migrant crisis in 2015-2016, and now the COVID crisis. They're all quite subtly different beasts that require different policy solutions, and yet the same arguments keep coming up again and again and again, which is, can we mutualize a lot of the stuff? And they say, not unreasonably, well, listen, if you want to do that, you have to kick in some extra taxes.
Yeah.
Right? And people go, no. And they say, well, okay, no thanks. Right? And so that's where I see the argument evolving into the future.
But this is causing a rift in European politics. You have the southern countries, for want of a better description, who are looking for some sort of debt write-down for everybody. And then you have the northern countries saying, well, no, you've got to carry the can yourself.
Yeah.
The can is too big for any individual country to carry. Hmm. So how do they expect Europe as an entity to exist after this?
So the basic idea is that it's never as bad as the southern Europeans say, right? But that's the first, you know, like, of course, people are going to jump up and down and make a big noise about, oh, my God, you absolutely have to do this. You have to change this. You know, it's, you know, the whole place is going to fall apart unless you do that. They're saying, well, we've heard that before, you know, and we've had these chats before. And sure, here we are, like, you know, and we're still, it's okay. It reminds me, I studied at a place called New School for Social Research in New York. And you know, it's kind of anti-equilibrium economics, you know, the kind of like supply equals demand kind of stuff that you're taught in an undergrad. And it would be a bastion of what's called heterodox economics, which is basically, maybe the market isn't always efficient, right? Maybe the government isn't useless. So the argument given by many of the proponents of equilibrium economics is, look outside. Everything isn't exploding. Things must come to some stable sort of outcome at the end. And if you think about it, you know, lifetime, intertemporal, substitution of income, you know your income fully into the future, you know, all that. The only kind of people who think that way are like tenured professors in American universities and priests, right? They're the only two types of people who know what their income is from now until they die, right? And everyone else is like, no, there's a lot of uncertainty and things go up and down. So it's quite an interesting thing, because that exact argument, look outside, things haven't collapsed, is completely true up until the exact moment that it's not, right?
But, so
which is the same argument I hear about climate change all the time. They keep saying, you know, I'm looking outside and they go, well, you know, that storm we just had, it's a one in every 100 years and we've had three in the last 10. And they go, yeah, but it's nice today.
Precisely.
But so taking that logic step forward, though, as you said, it's only good until it's not. And if that is the case, then, you know, it is only one thing. It's like, I mean, I really do personally, I believe, and I think you spoke about it as well as written about it, the fact that it's going to be very difficult now, because we've talked about, you mentioned the global financial crisis and then the sovereign debt thing. That's different to saying you've just buried your grandparents and now we expect you to, you know, pay a COVID tax. That's a very different question you're asking people there. And I think that emotionally, the EU has got the tone wrong.
I could really perceive the frustration coming. Like, it was, they were just radiating frustration from the officials in the Department of Finance and in other places. You know, when they're saying to each other, like, look, there's nobody's sinned here. There's no moral hazard. Nobody's like, oh, you have dodgy banks and a property market that isn't, you know, with dodginess. It's like, no, there's none of that. If anything, the southern countries kind of acted faster, although again their reactions were heterogeneous. But the lack of moral hazard is one of the key issues here. No one has got anything, no one has sinned in this particular scenario. It's actually it's quite interesting, because, you know, you would imagine that they would go, well, there's a bailout fund there. We're just going to make it available. You just push a button, fill out a form, money will fly from the ceiling, job done. And they're like, no, actually, the way this works is we issue debt to the markets. The markets will buy that debt. We will then write a note to you saying you owe us a proportion of that debt. Here's the interest rate. Take the money. Off you go. Now, that feels like a bailout at the level of a sovereign, because that debt is typically paid off much later in the day. But the reality of the situation is, from a balance sheet perspective, all you've done there is take out another loan, right? That's actually all you've done, yeah? And we're very lucky in this country that we have the NTMA, and they're an unsung bunch of heroes within the institutional firmament of the Irish economy. They get a lot of stick because they get really, really well paid. Like, they get properly paid, but they do an amazing job, which is that they keep the cost of borrowing low. So you're paying them a fair whack of a salary, like more than private sector salary. But on the other side, they're saving a massive amount of money in interest, because they know really what they're doing, and they're private sector operators. So that's a good thing. But the NTMA knows how to manage the profile of our debt, so that we pay back a certain amount at a certain amount of time, and they know when to issue debt and so forth. But ultimately, that institutional capacity aside, we still don't actually, you're not getting something for free. Jean-Claude Trichet had a really good piece in The Currency. He was interviewed by my colleague, Thomas Hubert. And Trichet said, look, yes, everyone needs money, but you shouldn't, you know, assume that it's free. And I was really struck by that, because this guy ran a central bank. And the fundamental thing about a central bank is that they can create as much money as they want, right? And it is free, or near free. And so it's really interesting, you know, like the Bank of England at the moment, it's not really monetary financing. It's not like they're printing off pounds and handing them to the Bank of England. What they're doing is they're saying, here, you can have an overdraft, lads, but don't worry about paying it back. You'd be right. That kind of fast financing thing, if you just think about it for a little while, you realize, okay, it's not that difficult to make these work if you really want to. Again, the COVID crisis has taught us, if you really, really want to do something, and there's a big enough, you know, the narrative is strong enough, hello, there's a pandemic, then you can get a lot done. It might be the most efficient. Now, a really important point is, you're not doing it with the appropriate checks and balances, right? So you can do the wrong thing very quickly, and that's that's sort of an important point. There have been some discussions about, well, maybe it's important that we pause human rights, for example. There have been some discussions about, oh, well, perhaps in this scenario, it's completely appropriate that we take private consultants and the lists of people that they're going to see and push those people to the onto the public lists, right? And creating an inequity for those individual patients, but maybe equalizing equity at the level of the system. But if you're waiting to have a cataract removed or something from via a private ophthalmologist, is that what? Right? Yeah, right. The eye doctor, right? Whoever he or she is, it doesn't feel very equitable. Now, again, it's a pandemic. As we have to say like five times a day, it's a pandemic. That's why we can't do this. In these situations, what you will pretty much always end up with is a huge amount of what economists call deadweight loss, which is like an excess burden. It's stuff that shouldn't, in a perfect market, wouldn't have been paid. It's the kind of thing that in an ideal scenario, in an ideal situation, people wouldn't work. People wouldn't be bearing. And in this situation, no one cares about because the government is bearing the excess burden. Right. So
currently,
the COVID payment, the completely fair point. So the COVID payment, the working payments, and so forth, they're all massively expensive, ferociously expensive payments. The payments of there are some reports that they're in the hundreds of millions to private hospitals to do that, to all this stuff. So people are happy that this is happening. They're supportive. They recognize. You know, again, hands up. It's a pandemic, but at a certain point, this has to be paid for, precisely. And at a certain point, these supports have to stop.
We've been very lucky that we spoke to Anthony Flynn, for example, in his Inner City Helping Homeless recently, and he spoke about the fact that some of the rates we're paying for some of this emergency accommodation is pre-pandemic rates. And you're going, we could have done better than that. Units were empty. We should have done better than that. And it's likewise with the private hospitals. I just want to go back on the central bank thing. I can't remember who it was, but it was definitely the British or English central bank that said that, you know, to be the best thing to be a central, how to be a central banker is to never let anybody know what a central banker does. And if you, and if you shake, what is it? If you carry a big stick, but never use it, because if you
speak softly, but carry a big stick.
Yeah. And if you, and be careful if you ever use it, cause it might break in your hand.
Yes.
That reminds me, you know, if we take that out to a broader thing, the idea of euro bonds, or I remember back in the debt crisis when Yanis Varoufakis was everywhere talking about, you know, how we'd use the European Investment Bank to buy a sovereign debt, and we could write down national debts by about a quarter. I happen to believe that all of these things that seem impossible very much can be done. Everything's impossible until it's done. The idea of a sovereign bond, and you see the difficulty, obviously there's in the EU at the moment, there is a polarization. There's problems with Hungary, there's problems in Poland, we're seeing Crete, and we're even seeing now, you know, as you said yourself, pushback on, you know, personal freedoms and liberties and stuff like that. So we do need to understand that the way you grow, the way I think you can tackle that is by showing some sort of EU solidarity. The idea of corona bonds.
Yeah.
Will they come back on the agenda?
No, I don't think they will, because remember, solidarity doesn't just mean from the rich to the poor. It also means from the poor to the rich. And if you think about it, most of the inequality is inside of a country, not between them. So there's a lot of people in Germany who are like, why would my taxes go up to help those people, right? The idea of a federal tax is actually a very good idea. Fundamentally, we're in a federation now. That's what it is. Well, no, that's not fair. What it really is a currency board. Formally, it's a currency board. So it's quite different, to be honest. But it's not fair to call it a federation, but it's very, very close to a federation. And the another word I learned in graduate school was non-ergodic. So non-ergodic means you can only go looking at something going forward isn't the same as looking at something going backward, right? So once you're in a monetary union, getting out of it is incredibly difficult. If you were to tell me or to ask me, Stephen, do I think Ireland should join a monetary union? I would say no. I think that's a poor choice. I don't think it was a good idea. And what you find actually is lots of economists like Patrick Honohan, who ended up running the central bank, actually writing in the 90s, this is a bad idea, we shouldn't do this. People like Tony Ledden and other people saying this is a pretty poor choice for us. But you know, Albert Reynolds came back and he gave us millions of reasons to go into this thing. And once you're in it, right, you either go 100% into it or you reverse at the door. We're seeing how difficult it is to do a Brexit, and they don't have the monetary problems, right? For a country like Ireland, there is a very very strong argument actually that we should be contributing to some kind of federal tax thing, and then the benefits will come proportionally. Now, you said it already. We're not in a moment where people want to have more international cooperation, right? Where they want less international cooperation. We're in a moment where renationalizing competencies is not just fashionable, it's probably actively desirable. Think about manufacturing capacity. In the 70s, 30% of Australian GDP was just manufacturing. They made stuff. They made cars, they made planes, they made all kinds of stuff. Now, it's only 6%. They don't make really anything. They do services, they do financial services, whatever, and they've arbitraged a lot of their stuff to China, and it makes a lot of sense why they've done that, right? Post-COVID, it may make an enormous amount of sense to renationalize some of that manufacturing capability, which is good at one level, because it's very good for employment. It's very good for skills. It will change the nature of our education system, but it won't be very efficient, right? So it'll be like Argentina in the 19th century. We're like, oh, we'll have our own coal industry. We'll have our own, you know, we're going to buy back Aer Lingus. We'll have our own airline, whatever. But they won't be that efficient. And because they won't be that efficient, we'll have to pay higher prices. But that's okay because we'd be getting higher wages, you know, and we might equalize the levels of income inequality. We probably won't equalize the levels of wealth inequality, about which we know almost nothing in this country, by the way. There have been two surveys on wealth in this whole country in 2013 and 2018, and they're okay. I don't want to give out about the people who've made it, but that's all we've got. So, yeah.
But is that not the argument going forward for Europe, for the countries of Europe? When you're deciding who's going to pay for this, we're already seeing unrest in southern Spain. We're seeing unrest in Italy. And people are saying, no. Why aren't we taxing wealth for this? Why is it going to come back? The austerity left us flat-footed in dealing with the crisis. So how is austerity going to fix or put us in a position to deal with a similar crisis in the future? For me, I see a catch-22 there, that no matter what economists want, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to sell that to people twice in 10 years.
Oh, you're not. And I mean, there were lots of economists writing about what a bad idea austerity was, you know, 10 years ago too. Yeah. Probably the best book, if listeners of this podcast will love, is called Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea by Mark Blyth from Brown. Fantastically well-written book. And it really gives you the history of where the notion of compressing your domestic economy in order to win the confidence of some external, you know, group of people, the markets.
Yes.
I always tell my students, you know, the markets. We talk about the markets as if they're this omniscient entity when they're really coked up 28-year-olds who buy Portuguese sovereign debt but don't know where Portugal is. You know.
Yes.
So that's you know, like we should never forget that if the market was doing its job efficiently, Enron wouldn't have happened. You know, so anyway, or Anglo even. But the major kind of element about the next couple of months is I don't think the next budget, for example, is going to instantiate increases in things like income tax, simply because people don't actually have the incomes to tax anyway. Right. And you will see things like increases in consumption, so VAT,
Yeah.
Right. Things like that. Excise duties, the usual. But I see a very strong argument now for the best property tax, best wealth tax, which is a property tax, right? A site value tax, in fact, is the best property tax. A garden tax, as it's often called. That is the best property tax. Now, only a government with like an enormous majority of essentially urbanites will pass something like that. But economically speaking, it's the best tax. And then financial wealth in the Irish economy is fairly large, it's fairly broad. It's worth taxing. Now, we shouldn't forget there's an inequity to every tax, right? So if you turn around and say, we're going to tax wealth, where's wealth? Wealth in the Irish economy, according to the Household Finance and Consumption Survey, is in basically three places. About 70% of it is in residences. Mm. So you got to do a property tax. And it's got to be fairly significant, right, in order to make things work. The second area where wealth is pensions. So this is money that people have saved for, you know, 40 years of their lives. You tax this, they're going to go bananas, right? And you should just, like Michael Noonan did it, and he did it at a very small level. I think it was 0.5%. Like, it was a tiny little tax, and people went bananas. And, you know, you can see why. They said, look, we've got tax taking it out. We've got tax putting it in. Yeah. Now it's in there, and you're taxing us again. Like, you could see there's an inequity to this kind of double and triple taxation. And the third place where there's actually a fair bit of wealth is in equities. So people have lots of wealth in stocks, shares, and bonds, and so forth. Now, which category of bonds do you want to tax? So people are more than happy to tax bondholders, right? But what about prize bondholders? You're going to tax the bonds you got as a present off your granny. There's a tremendous, tremendous amount of wealth in our society that's held effectively as state savings, right? You could tax that if you like, but
surely, I mean, myself and Martin have argued over the property tax. We've seen the thing about the site value tax, and we've spoken to some people who are big advocates of the site value tax and how it is more equitable than, say, the current property tax that is, you know, let's just face it, was another fudge. You know, it satisfied nobody except for maybe a certain cohort, and you know, we've seen they've been terrified to put it up in the last number of years when it's clearly not fit for purpose. So we've known that they're already afraid of it. However, we do have to address taxing wealth in this country. Absolutely. If we want, by the way, to be able to say things like housing is a human right, that doesn't, it's great just saying housing is a human right, then you got to bring that into then you got to produce the properties, the adequate housing, and to do that we need to broaden the tax base, and we need to look at all these other aspects of it. Mm-hmm. But I would then say that on the flip side, we keep getting hit with the fear of capital flight.
Yeah. So I was quite struck by a proposal by Sinn Féin in the last general election, which feels about 4,000 years ago. Yeah. Really does.
the one that they won. Sort of.
Actually, well, we might talk about that in a second. But there was a proposal essentially to tax intangible capital that was in the state. And there's a lot of it. Like, there really is a lot. There's hundreds of billions of intangible capital. And what intangible capital is revenue from other places that are part of a multinational's company structure that is effectively paid to its. So you sell an Apple iPhone in Germany, you pay the value of the iPhone not in Germany, but in Ireland, right? So you remit the value of the money as an intellectual property revenue or a licensing revenue to the Irish subsidiary. And then it pays little to no tax on that because of our taxation rules and because of the nature of the interaction between the US, the Irish, the Dutch, and the German taxation system in this case. Anyway, there's a lot of cash sitting there. It's a tremendous amount of wealth. There's an argument that it was a policy mistake to bring it in this way. There's another argument that is actually a resource boom. So this is a shed load of cash, I nearly didn't say shed there. It's quite a lot of cash.
Yes,
quite a lot of cash. And there's a very strong argument that it should be taxed appropriately. And I think in doing something like that, you would get an awful lot of tax in the first year. Because the money's captive, right? The second year, there'd be a lot of movement out. So, again, I think I've mentioned already, my colleague Thomas Hubert and I have started writing a paper about the effects of the Trump tax in 2017, which came in 2018, on the multinationals. So we have got data on the Irish subsidiaries of the multinationals. So we've got data on 113 US multinationals and 261 of their subsidiaries. And Thomas went through the balance sheets of each and every one of them because he's a legend, and then mapped them beautifully. And you can see the complexity of these corporate structures. But what's really interesting is we have the data from 2018, pre-tax, pre the imposition of the tax. Tax signed into law in 2017, became effective in 2018. And then we've got the 2019 books. So we've got this kind of A-B test, no law, law. And what we see is a massive movement of capital out of the Irish economy and back to the US.
Repatriated the money.
Yeah, yeah. And we think it saved them $66 billion. Okay. So capital flight is an issue, but it sounds like $66 billion sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. That's roughly the amount that the state pays for everything in taxes. We're talking about hundreds of billions. So you probably get a big hit of cash in the first year and it would drop off. Mm. And the thing about the reason I was quite supportive of the tax is that we would discover what's called the elasticity of taxation. We would discover how responsive the tax is or the funding is with respect to the imposition of the tax. Mm. Now, the whole money will fly away thing, you know, it's not that helpful that it's here in the first place to the average Irish taxpayer.
We don't get much from it anyway.
No, that's fair. That's fair. Now we do get jobs from large multinationals that pay in aggregate probably 50% of all the taxes in the state, right? So, in aggregate, they actually do. Like if you remove them from the system, the tax base is 50% lower. They're 40 to 50% lower, which means we can't afford the health or education systems, which is not ideal, right? So I think with all this. The economics of it are fine and interesting, but I'm far more interested in the political economy of it, which is that there's an extra constraint around this, which is that you have to run the economy within a society and not the other way around. And I've always been quite heartened by the fact that Pascal Donohue, who basically says this every time he opens his gob, he says this, and I'm very happy that he does say it. But he's under a series of constraints that maybe we don't see. Right now, the argument for our current tax system is that it's massively progressive above a certain level for income. I don't really know what it looks like for wealth, and I don't think anybody else does either. We take a lot of our taxes from a very small base, which is very, very risky for us, right? Especially going forward, renationalization. I've been writing about this for about 5 years now. I'm really worried about this because this is a key risk to the state. The only way around this risk is taxing everybody more, right? So, and I've been arguing about this with my colleagues, particularly in work and employment studies in UL for years, which is like, if we want a social democratic system, we have to increase the taxes of people at the lower end of the spectrum quite significantly, you know? And that's not an argument that anyone wants to have, because that is going to feel like austerity, even though it's not austerity. Austerity, remember, is decreasing the size of the domestic economy to pay off bondholders that are out there. This is taxing people to give them back more services, right? So a really interesting problem is the sequencing of the increases in taxes, because there are going to be tax increases, right? But this time, I have a very good friend. Her name is Anne Blake, and she's a playwright. And she said, you know what the difference is, that this time feels like we're bailing each other out. We're not bailing them out. And I thought that was quite profound. So we're bailing each other out. What we're doing is we're increasing the scale of taxation in order to provide better public services, cheaper childcare, better healthcare, better education, better housing, right? That's cool as long as it happens. Now, I don't think the public, like we both said this, I don't think the public are going to wear increasing taxes on lower income workers and poorer people before you increase taxes on people who earn more, right? Like, I don't think they're going to wear that.
It won't happen.
I think if you did it in the following sequence, just speculatively, do the intellectual property taxation thing. Mm. Increase taxes on people who earn over 100 grand, right? Who probably have far more savings, and who in the current crisis are probably forced to save more, right? It's highly likely that there's a whole class of worker who are actually, they're not better off, but they're not worse off, if that makes any sense. So they're not going out, they're not going to the cinema, they're not buying anything, they're not going on holidays.
They don't go to patreon.com for
they don't go to Patreon. yeah, exactly. So they're actually doing all right. And there's a fair whack of those people, right? There's probably 22,000, 25,000 people in the country earning over 100 grand, right? You could increase their taxes by 2-3%, they wouldn't be happy about it, like the pensioners and whatever, right? They wouldn't be happy about it, but they could wear it, is my point. Mm. Do that in sequence. So tax the intangible capital, tax people on higher incomes, and then say, listen, everybody, if you're on 20 grand, you're paying 2% of your taxes. If you're on 10 grand, you're paying 1% of your taxes. What's that called? That's the USC.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? We took people out of the USC. Now, why did we do that? Like, I think on a solidarity basis, right? Remember, we're talking about European solidarity. Yes. Solidarity has to come from the top to the bottom and from the bottom to the top in order to actually produce a social democratic system, right? Where high value, where everyone pays something. The problem is that feels a lot like austerity unless you're getting some kind of service in return. The money that runs the state, where it comes from matters, right? And this is the political economic reality of it. The reality of it is, if I pay taxes and you don't, I can shout louder than you, right? Mm. I especially, and if you were a really, really big taxpayer, you know, you're getting a meeting. Mm. You're getting a hearing. Your concerns are listened to, right? The economist, I'm a big fan of his work, he's got called Gabriel Zucman.
Yeah, yeah.
Berkeley, great guy. And
called us a tax haven.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote an article, I think it was in 2011 in the Irish Independent, called Let's All Admit That We're a Tax Haven. Mm. And people went mental.
Yeah, of course.
They really did. And I mean, this wasn't sort of Steve Brave, truth teller, you know, that wasn't what was happening, right? That wasn't what was happening to us. It was like, look around, you know?
Yeah.
And in the same vein, like if we just, so Zuckman's point about wealth inequality, to go back to him, his point is, wealth buys access.
Right,
and that is true. That's just true. Task years ago did an amazing piece of work called Mapping the Golden Circle. I don't know if they ever repeated it, actually. I must check it out. But this is maybe 2011. But all they did was, it was a really simple study. They just went online and they just looked at the membership of corporate boards. Mm. And they just saw that Joe Bloggs was on about six of them, you know. And it was an interesting thing to do. And I wonder, is it true now?
Well, I'd say anecdotally, if you look at where a lot of ex-political characters have ended up, it is purely for access. It is purely for access. Can I ask a question, Stephen? And back
Go
to
over it.
It's the pandemic. The longer this goes on, the less conventional models are applicable. Am I right on this?
That's completely true.
So the further you go on with this, the more outside of the box you have to go.
Completely right.
So you're going to tell people, we'll say it's 18 months a vaccine comes along, and another 6 months, 8 months before the whole world can say, okay, we restart where we left off. Are you then going to be able to turn around to people and say, look, you've lost quite a lot through all of this? Jeff Bezos has made a fucking fortune, but we're not going to touch him. Yeah. We're not touching him. We're coming after you. Yeah. Now, I can't see that fly in any country in the world. I can't see it fly.
I can't see people wearing it. I said this in a few places. At the end of this crisis, now, first off, we're all assuming it's a curve. We're talking about flattening the curve. I think we'll actually end up flattening this curve. And then the subsequent curve. So that's just my own personal opinion. And that completely adds to your point, which is it will, that's why the ISRI didn't produce forecasts. They produced scenarios a couple of weeks ago, because the models don't run with this level of a shock. Why? Because the models are equilibrium models, right? They're models where everything goes back to the way it was. And I don't think that's going to happen in this case. I don't think people at the end of this crisis, when their loved ones have died and they've lost their jobs and their businesses are in bits, I really, really, really don't think that they're going to wear more austerity, which is why I was quite surprised. It's why I was quite surprised to read in the document that the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil put together that there would be no tax increases for income tax in USC. I thought, you know, I think a sustainable path has to be sort of driven out of it, but it's much more difficult to do. I also think that all the previous electoral result was based more or less on how are you going to spend this 11 billion, lads? Right, that was more or less it, right? Yeah. And I don't want to invoke the fiscal space argument too much, because I'm not a huge fan of it, but more or less, they said the economy will grow by this much. The amount, policy free amounts is this much. The wedge between the two is 11 billion quid. That's not true, right? That the political pledges that were made, the arguments that were made around that, are all now utterly invalid. Yeah. Like they're invalid. They're invalid for every political party, not just the ones on the right or the left or anywhere else. It is interesting to me, the public made their choices based fundamentally on a set of assumptions about the world, which didn't include a global pandemic. Now, the political parties are having to square this reality off. But the truth about it is, you could very easily sign up to a program for government which says, there'll be no income tax increases, and it'll be, we're going to spend more on green priorities and whatever. And then at the end of it, find that there's another curve. There's another curve to flatten. You have to restrict the economy again. Things get worse. The deficit explodes again, and there's no money for anything, right? And I think it is just interesting that the configuration of the doll now, in terms of its percentage breakdown, is essentially the configuration of a doll where they're like, oh, we're kind of sick of the center-right guys. Some of us want to give these guys a bit of a go. And there's a whole hodgepodge of like smaller parties and independents. If you ran the election today, I wonder what outcome would you get, right? You might get, I don't know, you might get a very, very left-leaning and majority. Right, the public in the last crisis, the electoral reaction last crisis was to deliver a gigantic majority for a coalition government. I wonder whether the same this time. If they said, and let's abstract away from the logistics of actually running an election in a fucking pandemic. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse here.
Yeah, okay,
I apologize.
We've asked that question.
Oh, really?
So
run the electoral mathematics again. I don't know what the people are going to say.
In the US, they've said it's going to cost $2 billion. If the estimate cost is $2 billion if they were to hold the US presidential election by mail.
By mail.
Mm. gave everybody vote by mail. They said it cost $2 billion, I think is their estimate. So could you, so just, you know, taking it down to it, so you can do these things, but it's a huge cost, even in a small country like Ireland.
Let me ask you, if you, so we'll say that we don't know the timeline, and that's the big issue here is nobody knows what this timeline is, or even if this timeline is ever gone away. There is no guarantee of a vaccine. Mm-hmm. So this, exactly, you know, there, you don't know if this timeline is ever going away. So how do you then, on a micro level, tell your citizens, here's our 5-year plan, when you can't plan 5 weeks or 5 months?
So is it
then not, this document from government is more a surrender and confidence than a supply and confidence? You are... basically, if you sign up to this, you are surrendering any chance of anything other than a neoliberal exit from this, if the exit ever comes, which means austerity in some form or another.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. So I don't know if you're surrendering that. I think one of the things that I was very, very, very clear on, and I keep going back to it, is the need to actually tell people how you're going to deliver this thing, because that answers that question for you. Right. If you don't, if you say, listen, it's going to be grand, we've got 5 years, it's going to keep growing, it's going to be, like, and then it doesn't turn out that way, and you have to, you know, reduce spending on higher education, for example, or cut off the housing program, destroy the capital, like capital projects that are currently running, you know, which might be imperfectly designed, whatever, but somebody's building a house owned by someone, right? If they stop, if the state stops providing that service, the deficit that accrues, it accrues like wealth accrues. It's negative wealth, right? It's what we, it's where we should have been. I often look at the Spire. I remember, the Spire in Dublin? Remember the row that people had around that? And I remember when they installed the Spire, I was actually standing on O'Connell Street watching them build it. And they sort of built it by kind of like putting the rings on top of each other and like welding it around. And then there was some lad who was the Spire polisher, which is a really interesting job to have. Anyway, whatever. They built the Spire. And I'm standing at the bottom of O'Connell Street. I'm looking up at the Spire. And I never saw the point of it before it was all the stuff was cleared away. Because the Spire kind of showed like, well, this is sort of where we should be, you know? The building should be this high. If we'd actually managed to develop properly, we'd have six pretty high. And we don't. They're two stories. And you're like... oh, that's, I often think, you know, if you had sort of a measure of, you know, this is where you should be, and you're like, why aren't we there? Well, because we boom and we bust, right? And here we are staring into the bust. So go back to the delivery thing. I really do think that there's a very strong argument that we should commit to two budgets a year. So two budgets a year allows you to adjust the parameters of the state very quickly. So we had two budgets in 2009, for example, that were very, very effective. Now, they were effective at increasing taxes and reducing spending, but they were very, very effective, right, at righting the ship of state, as it were. I think that's a very good idea in the current circumstances, because precisely as you say, if you end up in a situation where you don't actually know how much is coming in the door in the next 6 months, you're not actually able to plan for 5 years hence. And we're part of the European semester system. We actually have to produce these sort of forecasts every so often. And what you notice if you look at them as regularly as I do is that after 3 years, everything's, you know, they always come back after 3 years. And if you compare the plots of these things over time, they always get a little, they always get a little bit more difficult to believe. You know, they're corrosive of credibility, and that's not what you want to be doing as a finance minister.
Stephen Kinsella, I think we will leave it there. I just reminded one thing. Do you remember the free newspapers they used to hand out as you're getting off the Dart in town, and you'd be getting what was the one they used to have in Dublin? The free newspaper, and they were putting up the spire. And I was in a bank on O'Connell Street at the time for a number of years, and the spire was being put together, as you say. And I remember the headline one morning, because I didn't even realize the spire had been finished. We were that fed up of it, and the headline in the newspaper was, "I can see Cleary's now. The crane is gone."
I do actually. I think it's probably a fairly. I suppose amazing is the wrong word, but turbulent time for economists. You know, everything that economists have every belief system that ever existed is now up for grabs.
Yeah, I think what's fantastic about economics at the moment, like I love teaching economics, I love learning economics, is that it never stops. So one of the former deans of the County Business School where I work, he said, you know, the best thing about economics is that the questions change, but the answers do.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening now, right? The questions are still the same. How are we going to run a decent society? How are we going to pay for everything? How are we going to make sure that everyone, you know, has the best possible life that they could possibly have? But the answers are totally different to what they were in January of 2020.
Stephen Kinsella, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Stephen.
Listen, folks, if you want to join us on Wednesday evening, head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We will be doing a live show, and we're hoping to have a bit of crack. Might even get a laugh out of Martin. Talk to you all soon. Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.